Welcome to episode 127 of the Horror Podcast. My name is Tyler, and by day, I am just an ordinary teacher. And by night, I transform into that same ordinary teacher, but I like to talk about spooky shit. So I am joined tonight, as I am joined most nights, by the co-hostess with the mostest, the snazziest skeleton I know, Oren Gray. Oren, what's going on, man? What have you been up to?
I've not much, as usual. Just watching movies and, you know, working and that kind of junk.
Very good. Very good. I know that you have some very special announcements to make, so I won't step on that because I think it's really big and exciting news. So tonight, we are going to discuss what we've been reading, what we've been watching. We're going to highlight some free content on the internet with our dark corner of the web. And then finally, we're going to head out to our local drive-in to examine the mass shooter movie, Targets. But before we get there, Oren, what you reading, what you writing, what you watching, you know, what's going on? What kind of content have you consumed?
I saw the new Candyman, which I think you did as well, and it was super good. I've seen a lot of people who did not think it was super good, so maybe we're in the minority there, I don't know, but I really liked it. And it was my first time seeing like a first run movie in the theater since Underwater. So a long ass time ago, like right before the pandemic. Yeah. So that was exciting and that was fun.
Candyman's great. I think we have plans to devote a whole episode to it, so we won't step on our messaging there too much. But I have seen some excellent, solid criticism from critics of color that take issue with some of the themes and you know, the elements of the movie. And I would absolutely say, like, listen to your critics of color on this one for sure. But I fucking loved it, and I want five more movies all with different Candymen in them. So, yeah.
Yeah, it was a great time. It was a great time. Like, if anything, like, overstuffed, that's the one criticism that I see almost everyone make and that I 100% agree with, but also like I'll take an overstuffed movie over a movie with nothing in it. It was a good time. I had a fun. I've been watching that. I know, so you wanted me to mention, I'm putting the finishing touches on what is going to be my next collection. It's very, very premature to announce it at this point because it's not going to be out until like this time next year. But
that's exciting though, man. That's awesome.
You know, publishing is a slow business, so it'll probably be out in October of 2022. So I'm finishing putting it together and we'll be sending it off to Ross at Word Horde any day now, and we'll start that. Start all those many big geared wheels turning.
Awesome. Yeah, man. I am stoked. I poured through Guignol in like a half a fucking minute. So I'm ready. I'm ready to explore the world of Oren Gray. Is there like a theme that governs some of this, or is it kind of hodgepodge?
And it's a little bit hodgepodge. Like it's not. So the only collection I've ever done that was like explicitly themed before I started was Painted Monsters, which I wanted to do, horror movies, and I wanted to do them kind of in order of when they were released, kind of a thing. All the others have been like ostensibly unthemed, but then as I was putting them together, like themes appeared. There'll probably be some of those in this one, but there's no specific like set theme in advance. It will be my longest one ever though, so.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's at the moment it's like 5,000 words longer than Guignol was, and I think Guignol was my longest before that. So
awesome! So many exciting things, dude. I love it. I love it. Yeah, can't wait to get it and to check it out. Anything else to mention on your watch and reading list?
I don't think so. I'm sure I'm forgetting something, but.
All right, so I got to tell you, the thing that has dominated my life this last kind of week in the best way possible. Okay, so Mondo sent me a copy of their newest coffee table book right here. Uh-huh. You see, Warped and Faded. The exact title is Warped and Faded, Weird Wednesday, and the Birth of the American Genre Film Archive. And essentially, it's like a collection of oral histories about how, like, oh, Weird Wednesday got started at Alamo Drafthouse, how AGFA got started, and, like, it's beautiful. I'm probably doing it terrible justice here, but it's full of, like, these, like, old one sheets from these weird movies. And the long story short is, like, this rebirth of all these, you know, like Vinegar Syndrome and all these kind of boutique Blu-ray folks that we really, really, really like, really just owe it up to these individual collectors of reels that happen to be in and around outside of Kansas City, believe it or not, because there was a huge film warehouse archive that had a bunch of these old things. And one of the guys that started Weird Wednesday bought like 1,000 films for like $500, and only maybe 150 of them were like salvageable, but like they had enough for 150 Weird Wednesdays, you know? And that has always been, I would say, like kind of a subset of what we do that I haven't necessarily fully embraced. I don't know a ton about it. It wasn't necessarily my speed. That shit's my speed now. Like, it was just fascinating to read all about it. So I don't think it's out for another like month or two, but absolutely worth it. If you were a big fan of the Alamo Drafthouse, if you were a big fan of just weird, crazy exploitation shit from the 70s and early 80s, like, this is going to be it for you. So it's real, real, real awesome. Also, anything Mondo does, I automatically, like, it gets like plus 10, you know, like if it were a Dungeons and Dragons character, it would get like plus 10 coolness factor because Mondo does rad shit, you know, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
So I've done that, and I am in the final chapter of the Final Girl Support Group, which is Grady Hendrix's new novel. I don't think I quite like it as much as I liked his previous novel that came out last year. It was like
Vampire Hunter. Yeah.
It was like the Southern Woman's Guide to Hunting Vampires or something, which I found charming, and like, it was a really simple story, but so fantastic. This is a little insider baseball. Oh, it looks like somebody said, we can't tell your name here, but somebody else left Southern Woman's Guide to Hunting Vampires or whatever that is. I feel like this novel is really like winking and nodding a lot at us who are fans, which is great. But I think there are a whole lot of people that are gonna get it and gonna be like, I don't know what this is, but this is not something that I can just pick up, right? Like, I think it really requires some previous knowledge and to get kind of all those jokes and everything. He's still a fantastic writer. It's totally worth a read. But you know, my next novel is, once I can get a hold of it. I can't get a hold of it yet, but you reviewed it for us, and I've heard it's very similar. So
there is a chainsaw, yes. It's super good.
Yeah, very good, very good. So yeah, I'm just rich with great books and things to read right now. So I'm super stoked about it. All right, you found our dark corner of the web this week. It is a fantastic, like, 5-minute horror short that you can find on YouTube here. Using kind of the Boris Karloff motif that we are going to talk about for the film. How'd you stumble across this?
So we're going to talk later about a story that I wrote that got published in The Dark, but that I read at the Outer Dark Symposium a couple of years ago when, you know, we still had things like symposiums.
People can get together, right?
So sometime after I read that story, someone pointed out this short to me because it's basically the exact same plot as my story, right? Like, and it is.
It is eerily similar.
It is eerily similar. And so I was like, well, shit. Oops. But yeah, that's how I found it. Was someone was like, hey, have you seen this? It's basically your story. And I was like, hey, so it is.
No shit. when it came out? Well,
I think it came out before, so it could have, yeah, but...
Yeah, but, like, I didn't recognize the YouTube channel. It's only got, like, 55,000 views or whatever, but it's fantastic. Like, it's just really well done and kind of really captures this sense of nostalgia that I think is in Targets for sure. So, yeah, I think we'll talk more in depth, but absolutely go check out this the short that we'll put the link to here in the show notes, because it's totally worth a watch. It's 5 minutes, man. Okay, so our essential question for today: why do so many horror movie villains steer away from mass gun violence, and what can Targets tell us about America's obsession with guns? So it's going to be a real light episode here on the Horror Podcast. It's going to be fantastic. But before we get into that discussion and we attempt to answer and solve all of America's gun problems tonight, let's take a look at the trailer for the 1968 Targets.
We thank you for the food we're about to receive in the Lord's name. Amen.
Amen. A typical American family at dinner. Mom and Dad, their beautiful daughter-in-law, and their only son, Joe, a homicidal maniac.
Harry! What are you doing?
How's your dad?
It's okay.
Here you go. Thanks a lot. What you hunting this time?
I'm gonna shoot some pigs.
Targets, a movie about a war inside a man's head.
Hey, what are you doing?
Peter Bogdanovich, the director of The Last Picture Show, takes you for a roller coaster ride through the canyons of a disturbed mind in Targets.
Get out the light! The light!
Stay in there, get down! Oh, there's somebody shooting out here!
In the window!
What turns an all-American boy into an all-American killer?
All right, before we get into our discussion, the Internet Movie Database gives us this little film synopsis. An elderly horror film star, while making a personal appearance at a drive-in theater, confronts a psychotic Vietnam War veteran who has turned into a mass-murdering sniper. I don't think that summary nor that trailer really does a good job of like detailing exactly what this movie is about. Maybe give us the Oren synopsis and why you picked the film.
First of all, I love that trailer doesn't have Boris Karloff in it.
In at all. Right.
He's at the tail end and it doesn't mention him. Like, what the hell? Like, he is literally the whole movie. But short version is, like, so Boris Karloff in this movie is basically playing himself. And Peter Bogdanovich is basically playing himself. And Peter Bogdanovich is trying to convince Boris Karloff to be in the movie that we're watching right now. And while this is happening, this guy who everything in the trailer happens, this guy decides to murder his family and then murder a bunch of other people. That's the plot part, but like what the film is about, like thematically, but I mean, it's about a lot of things. And we're going to talk about some of them like gun violence and all that, but why I picked it and what I find really fascinating about it is that it's a movie about the way horror was changing at that time. Like 1968 was kind of the crux moment in a lot of ways when horror shifted irrevocably away from the kinds of stuff that we'd gotten beforehand, the kind of stuff that Boris Karloff was known for, into stuff like this movie, into stuff about really banal, everyday kinds of violence, really stories about people being victimized for no reason without knowing why they were being victimized. Someone on Letterboxd put it as like the you started to get the more like documentary style horror movies. So you got stuff like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff like this. Like the sniper parts of this are very much you know, you are there now, this could happen to you, kind of stuff. And that's what horror was switching to at this time. And it's a movie about that switch happening and why it happened and like what drove it and what motivated it and all that kind of stuff. And I find that fascinating because this movie was made like as it was happening. It's not a movie that was made 10 years later or 20 years later, looking back. Like it hadn't even really fully happened yet when this was made. Like this was right on the cusp of it.
Yeah.
And I find that theme is what draws me to this movie and what I find really fascinating about it.
Yeah. And I think that comparison to Texas Chainsaw Massacre obviously is going to happen because of the year and the kind of patina of the movie, I think, lends to that comparison. But I think you're right. Like, this movie is not playful. This movie is not a wonderful 90 minutes where you can forget about your life, right? Like, I think intentionally so. It's the horror of reality, right? And
the two halves of it are even like split in how they're made. So like the half with Boris Karloff is playful. It is
right. Yeah.
Jokey. It's done like the banter between Karloff and Bogdanovich, the banter between Bogdanovich and his girlfriend, it's all very like 40s screwball comedy style.
Yeah, like a buddy cop film. Almost,
right,
yeah.
Yeah, the scene when Bogdanovich gets too drunk and goes to sleep in Boris Karloff's bed, like that's 100% a screwball comedy trope. Like that's, you know, and so all of those scenes are very old-fashioned, and then you have this very modern for 1968, you know, scenes with the sniper where it's very much, you know, you're not given any melodrama, you're not given anything. It's very banal. It's very everyday, ordinary stuff.
Yeah. And, I think if this movie was 90 minutes of just watching this guy kill people, right?
Oh yeah.
It'd be tough. Like it'd be a tough film to watch because I found myself there is about an 11 minute scene where, all we get is our sniper unloading guns, getting set up and getting ready to shoot people on the interstate. Right. But I counted it cause it kept going and going and going. It's 11 minutes of just looking at his guns essentially. Right. Which is full of dread and the kind of existential, potential violence that every gun is, you know, and it's a really weird mood, right? It's just what punctures that are these great, really kind of silly, very warm. Boris Karloff in this film is exceedingly warm. Like I want him to be my grandpa, you know, right. I think without that, the movie wouldn't be nearly as good, but B, I think would be exhausting, right? Like you'd just be like, I don't think so.
Right.
I'm going to stick this in the Requiem for a Dream category where, you know, it's a good movie, but I never want to see it again, you know?
Yeah, and so much of, and it's very intentional, so much of the sniper's story is not him killing people. He spends very little time killing people. He kills a lot of people, but he spends very little time doing it. Most of his story is boring minutiae.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's boring minutiae freighted with dread because we know he has a trunk full of guns.
Yeah.
Like, it's him going to the store, you know, it's him, like, watching TV. We watch him watching TV with his parents at one point. Like, it's just him doing boring, ordinary stuff, which again, like, it strips him as a figure of any, and intentionally, again, of any kind of grandeur, right?
Oh, right.
Because the kinds of monsters that Boris Karloff played and the kinds of monsters that Boris Karloff's talking about when he says the line that gave Mike Lutyens title, the no one's Mike in a horror is not horror anymore, no one's afraid of a painted monster, and he throws down the newspaper about the mass killing. Mm-hmm. You know, those monsters were, there was a grandeur about them and a magic about them, and they were big and imposing and important and all this stuff. And this guy's the opposite of that, right? Like, he is just an ordinary person, and fundamentally at the end, you know, to jump all the way to the end, but he's pathetic.
Right.
Right. Like, when Boris Karloff finally confronts him, he's pitiful. Right.
Right. He cowers.
Right. He's not a monster. He's just a broken person.
Yeah. And like a lot of the kind of what I absolutely loved about this film, a number of things, but the poster art here is just fantastic. Yeah. And really captures, I think, that time period. But a lot of the other publicity material really played up the fact that he is like a Vietnam vet, right? And I watched the backstory a handful of times, and like, I'm not getting a massive focus on that at all.
I mean, and I think part of it is basically just that he has to have been, because it was 1968.
Okay.
Unless he had a reason not to be, he was a Vietnam vet, right? Like, everybody was. You got drafted. Everybody got drafted. Like,
right.
You know, and it was, the movie doesn't play it up. You're right. It does not make a big deal. I'm not even sure it actually says it.
Yeah.
It may only imply it.
Yeah, I think the shopkeeper makes like the gun store owner makes like a veiled reference to the fact that they're glad he's around again or some shit. Right, yeah. And like, I think that's the extent of it, you know?
Yeah.
But I like, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so I've got an essay, and we'll put it in the show notes. I wrote about this subject, specifically about this movie and this subject, about the transition of horror between pre-60s and post-60s horror, for Nightmare Magazine, for one of their H-word essays, back in January. And like, the Vietnam War is essentially the crux of that transition in a lot of ways. And so like, I feel like the movie probably didn't feel like it had to say it, because
everybody knew it was ever present,
right? It was so baked into the culture at that time. Because like, one of the wild things about Vietnam is that it went on for decades.
Almost like 20 years, right?
Yeah. Yes. Like, it went on for more than a decade. Like, it's,
yeah.
And like, you know, like World War II didn't go on, like both World Wars combined did not go on as long as Vietnam did.
Right.
Like, and so, you know, it just permeated the public consciousness for that time so thickly that it's hard to sort of realize how much it did looking back. Because like, we had a 20-year war, but it did not bake in, because we didn't have the draft as much.
Right, right, right.
So it did not bake in as much to everything as Vietnam did. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bottom line. I'm sure both of us had friends that served in Afghanistan. Yeah, you know, a lot of us probably know somebody that died in Afghanistan. But it wasn't like everyone our age had to go do that, right? So, you know, we didn't have these mass memorials at high schools. They were like, here are the 30 or 40 kids that we lost that, you know, whatever. And
you know, fundamentally, like, Vietnam happened when TV was first happening. Right. So like, we were getting like images of the war on TV, and we got a bunch of images of Afghanistan, but we could just tune away from them.
Right.
But back then there were like three channels, right? Like, it was all that was on.
Right.
You know, there was no looking away back then.
And when the news came on, you watched the news. So yeah. Yeah. So all of this leads me, because legitimately I want to try to address the question tonight.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
We, I, when I was looking for movies that I thought were similar to this one, right? Like when I was trying to come up with my two movies that I would recommend alongside this, and you type in like mass shooter horror movies into Google, like there's fucking nothing there, right? Like there are a lot of thrillers. There are a lot of dramas, believe it or not. But straight up horror movies are really, really limited, which really reminded me of, and it looks like another Facebook user here commented that Grady Hendrix's book does comment on this as well. At least in Grady's mind, right? There's a reason why we don't see a lot of horror movies like that. And that's because the serial monster in most modern horror movies is an intimate thing, right? It happens in a bedroom. It happens with a knife. It's close. It's this very, I don't know, this very close and personal thing, right? And with mass shootings, especially with a lot of the ones that we've seen recently, there's not a rhyme, there's not a reason, it's not intimate, it is gross, not in a disgusting way, but like in a like massive size, right? It is cool, it is detached, right? And it's that detachment that I find so terrifying and so horrific, you know, and I don't know. I don't think that completely explains it, but I do think that that is a great entree point into that conversation for sure.
Yeah. Well, and I think in part, like you're essentially, and I know I saw some of the stuff that you were looking up when you were looking for this, and I saw some things that sort of suggested this, that like in some ways the problem is that it is too normal.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I mean, and specifically, and this is going to sound weird, someone shooting someone and killing them is not a big deal.
Right.
Right, like it happens all the time. It almost anyone. Like guns are the great leveler. This is why guns are such a great invention for warfare, is that any jackass can kill someone with a gun.
Right.
Like, it's not a big deal that someone kills a bunch of people with a gun, because anybody with a gun can kill a bunch of people.
Right.
I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but like, that's the gist of it, right? Like, you know, Michael Myers or Jason or whoever, then killing a bunch of people, that's abnormal. It's not usual for someone to have a knife and kill through a, you know, sub-development worth of people in a night. That's not normal.
Right.
But someone with a rifle killing a whole bunch of people, that's what rifles are for.
Yeah. And that's a fucking and that's a fucking Tuesday here, right? Like, right, yeah. You know, and yeah, so the article that you're referencing is fan-freaking-tastic, and I don't always love the New Yorker. I find some of their shit a little too highbrow for me, but they have an article that is called The Haunting Normalcy of Mass Shootings, and like part of the argument is that the detachment, the cool detachment of the mass shooter, right, has invaded the collective consciousness of the American public. That's not to say that like people who are the victims of that and their families and whatnot aren't devastated, right? And that's like, I can remember when Newtown happened, right? My son at the time was a kindergartner, so we were same age as all the kids that were shot. And I just remember looking at all those parents and, you know, all that kind of jazz. And the fact that we were able to collectively as a public move forward, right?
Yeah.
Is the most haunting thing that you could possibly say, right? Like, certainly all of these things happen, but our response to that has been, you know?
Well, and you get, and I know that, and again, I know there's an article that deals with this as well, but you get into the situation where, like, most of the time, right, in a slasher film, the slasher, at least initially, at one point, somewhere back in its progression, maybe not in the ninth installment of the series or whatever, it was a metaphor for something, right?
Sure. Like
it was a symbol, it was a metaphor. It also functions as, you know, as a slasher film and as this body count movie and whatever. But when you get into mass shootings, what are they a metaphor for? They're just a metaphor for themselves.
Right. Like they are the thing, yeah.
We have normalized them honestly, even by the time Targets was made, they were normal enough that they became just a metaphor for themselves. There was no deeper layer there. They were just, this is a thing that happens. Look, we made a movie about a thing that happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and like, I'll put a link to it here in the show notes too. It's fantastic. It's about a 15-minute interview with Bogdanovich, and fascinating is a poor term to describe it, because it's great. It's just like him sitting on a couch talking about the movie, which is amazing. But one of the things that he mentions is they wanted to make a movie that at least borrowed from some of the imagery and some of the ideas and some of the fear of the University of Texas shooter, right? And I think that was University of Texas. It was in Texas.
Sounds right, yeah.
Might have been Texas A&M. I don't know. But that was not that – that didn't happen a long time before Targets, right? Like, it was relatively recent. And then they make the movie, right? They get it in the can, and they end up selling it to distribution, which was a big deal. Because really, at the core of this movie is Roger Corman, which is where Peter Bogdanovich kind of got a start. And Corman is the one that greenlit the movie. And he just told Bogdanovich, it's your movie. I just want my money back. So if you can sell it to a distributor, and then you can do whatever you want to with it. So he was able to sell it. And before it came out, you saw Martin Luther King Jr. get assassinated and Bobby Kennedy. And there was a real conversation. They're like, fuck, is it irresponsible to put this movie out? What do we do with this thing? And ultimately, they made the conscious choice to put it out despite all of that. The only thing going through my mind in that interview was like, dude, we've been fucked for a long time, yeah. You know? Yeah. Like, these are issues that we refuse to deal with for ever and ever and ever and ever. So, yeah man. So that's part of it. I think the other thing is that even in the 60s, there is this ubiquity to how easy our guy can get a gun, how many guns he can have. Like, I don't know. Like, it's just kind of this place that he could go. And like at one point, he buys a bunch of ammunition, essentially on leverage, because his dad's in the store so much, they can, you know, charge it to my dad's account, which I found wild. So, but, you know, it is what it is.
I mean, and like, and this may be off slightly, I don't know, but we'll see where it goes.
Go for it.
Also, I mean, I think the ending of this movie also underscores why we don't see more mass shooter horror movies. Because when you get right down to it, the person at the other end of that barrel, right, the person pulling the trigger, is just a person. He's a pitiful, broken, scared, damaged person who needs help, who needs something. He's not something you should have to be afraid of.
Oh yeah, you're right.
Like,
yeah.
And even in the 70s, even in the late 60s, into the 70s, even at the height of the guerrilla filmmaking, the let's make film as realistic as possible, we still wanted a sense of grandeur from our movies. We wanted our movies to be more than just a documentary, right? We wanted a narrative with some scope and some power, and watching a broken person be broken isn't that. That's not
right.
What we want.
Yeah.
That's not what we want from a horror movie most of the time, right? Most of the time when we want a horror movie, we want a villain. We want a monster. We want a ghost. We want something more than just a sad, scared person.
Yeah. Well, and then it takes typically it takes like a final girl that has her own kind of survival instinct and is has some ingenuity and has some stick-to-itiveness, right? And it's this battle, right? But at the end, this man is essentially beaten by a 80-year-old kind of washed up movie guy that is just you know, like, hits him with his cane once. He's like, what the fuck are you doing? You know, like, stop. And the guy's like, you're right, I'm a piece of shit. It is.
And I mean, like, practically the last line of the film is Boris Karloff, like, looking at the guy huddled up on the ground crying. And he says, like, is that what I was scared of?
Yeah, right.
You know, and it's like, yeah, we... And there is a place for a movie like that, right? There's a place for a movie about this is a person who is broken and hurt, and that's all they are. There's nothing more to them than that. They're just a person just like you, except they're broken and hurt, and they hurt other people. But very few horror movies want to be that, right? Most horror movies want to be something more narratively exciting than that, or entertaining than that. I don't know what words to put on it, but like, very few movies want to be just that. And you can't be much more than that with a gun. No.
Like, you're 100% right. And then I think it leads really well into this other kind of thing that I clipped here. It is a Tumblr. Who knew those even existed anymore? But it's really, really well written. It's by an author named T.L. Bodine. And he's got a hypothesis that essentially there are more killers with axes than there are with guns for one of three reasons. Number one, primacy, essentially because there is always a mass shooting in the, like, the collective zeitgeist that we're parsing our way through, right? Like, one a week, one a day, you know, one whatever. Like, it's hard to make a horror movie about that because it's always too soon. Right? Like, it's like, oh, shit, I that just happened yesterday or whatever, right? So you can make a movie about an axe murder because those don't happen very often. Two is the politics of the movie are always going to be overshadowed because of the politics of gun violence, right? Like, even if you tried to make an apolitical movie about a mass shooter, it would never come across that way because the gun lobby would feel like it was a threat to its existence or whatever. So it's never going to get made because immediately half of the people in this country are going to, you know, get all upset about it. His third reason is logistics. He would argue it's just really hard to make a mass shooting event like that, have it look kind of realistic. It's horror movies at their core are supposed to be cheap, and a big mass shooting movie that had a bunch of extras and like dollies and cranes and shit to do it right is just a way more difficult movie than like a killer chasing somebody with a machete or whatever.
Right.
So.
And I know he mentions this too. Like it's also hard to fit it into sort of the framework that horror movies typically fit into, which is that, you know, the kills are usually one-on-one. There's stalking and there's tension buildup. There's not a lot of tension. And like targets generates tension because we know what's going to happen. Like it uses the Hitchcock method of generating tension where the audience knows something the people in the movie don't.
Right.
But
yeah.
You can't do that all the time, right? Like you can only do that so much. Horror movies have a whole repertoire of ways of generating tension that guns would mostly negate.
Right.
You know, they're loud, they're sudden, you can do them from a distance, and these negate all of the, like, stalking sequences and the killer's right there, where am I gonna go, am I gonna go here, am I gonna go there, it doesn't matter where you can go 100 miles away and they're still gonna shoot you, it negates a lot of the technique that horror movies rely on.
And I think what Bodine really hammers at the end, it gets into school shooters, right? And his big thing, right, his kind of the conclusion he reaches is that it's a cultural issue that we have been brought up from an early age that the good guy is the guy with the gun. Right. He's right. The police officer. He's the cowboy that's protecting the town. He's the fucking John Wicks of the world. Right. And I love no knock on John Wick. I love me some John Wick films. But like we are brought up to believe good guys have the guns. Right. And in fact, that's a whole mantra of half the people in this population about why we have them. So when you stick a kid in high school with a gun, our immediate assumption is not that he's going to, you know, is that he's going to defend the school, or he's going to, you know, like a la Toy Soldiers and Will Wheaton, right. He's going to, you know, prevent people from taking over his boarding school or whatever. Right. When in all reality, it's the exact opposite. Then yeah. That to me is totally fucked and totally right on, you know? Right.
Well, and I mean, and that brings up a thing that, like, is the other reason why we don't have horror movies about killers with guns, is that when you make a horror movie about a killer with a gun, you get John Wick.
Okay.
John Wick is a slasher movie where the slasher has a gun. He also happens to be our protagonist. But I mean, what? It's a guy who is coming. He's out for revenge for a wrong that was committed against him.
Oh, I like it. Okay.
You know, he goes through this long body count of people before he gets to the ones he's actually after, right? Like, it's fundamentally, structurally, essentially a slasher film. But when you introduce guns into a slasher film, you get an action film.
Well,
that's what you get. Like, that's what an action film is.
Yeah, no.
The structure of a slasher film with guns, right? Like,
well, and I think you're agreeing here with Bodine is yeah. If you make a horror film, but you give the monster a gun, that in our cultural zeitgeist immediately makes him the protagonist, which is super problematic for, you know, like the horror movie itself, right? Ah, I think that's, yeah. That is the shit and really interesting.
Yeah. And like, you know, and if you give the monster a gun, then everyone's going to expect, because we have, I mean, literally since the dawn of movies, we have this idea that you fight a gun with a gun, right? So as soon as you give the monster a gun, the hero, the protagonists are going to have a gun. And at that point, why don't they just kill the monster? What stops them?
Right, right.
You know, because then the playing field is ostensibly level, right? Because that's the other big myth we have, because we grew up watching gunfight movies, or our parents did, or our grandparents did, or whatever, right? Like, two people with a gun are equal.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, and I mean, none of that's necessarily true, but that's the cultural kind of baked in assumptions that
right.
we make without even realizing we're making them. And
yeah,
that means that if you give a slasher a gun, then the hero's going to obviously have a gun, and then there's no movie anymore all of a
right.
sudden. Right.
Yeah. Like, well, and it certainly it's got to change. Right.
Right.
Well, and I don't know. I think that there is maybe it's connection to reality and it being too close, you know, and all that kind of jazz. But like, I feel like there is some work, especially maybe in the Friday the 13th films, to like at least give some sympathy to the monster from time to time, right?
Right. Oh yeah.
And at least with this film, I don't think you don't get any sympathy for yeah. our shooter at all, like in any of the film.
One of the key things that this film does is that almost no, very few, even the most sympathetic, even like Maniac or whatever, very few slasher movies or any horror movies do, is that there's no reason he does this.
Right.
Like even Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the people who get killed, they're killed for no reason. They are picked for no reason. But there's a reason the Sawyer family's doing that.
Right, right.
This guy has no reason that we never know. I mean, I'm sure, you know, he presumably has a mental illness, but we never know what it is. We are never given any insight into why he chooses to do this.
Yeah, it probably could be its own show, but we would be remiss if we didn't devote at least a minute or two to it. Like, there are some things about this character that are prescient and important and really help bring this conversation, I think, full circle, right? He's a white man. Some might even argue a white boy, because he's not very old, right? He, you know, mm-hmm. like he's early 20s at the absolute oldest, I think. we know at one point, right? Like I found his interaction with his wife to be the most interesting, right? Because all of them live together in their parents' like home or apartment, and I couldn't kind of figure out what it was.
It's a home. It's like a suburban home, but yeah, it's hard to tell.
Yeah. So they all live together, which would fucking suck, but also reminded me of COVID. You know, it was like we're stuck together. You know, so we're all gonna watch TV together. Ooh. But at one point, he says to his wife, "Like, I think there's something wrong with me." She's like, "Oh, there's nothing wrong with you. You just need to, you know, go work on your car and relax," or whatever the hell she says. Yeah. Right. But she's very dismissive of the fact that, right, you know, he makes this brief attempt to reach out and get help. And like, I do think that there is probably a tacit discussion about mental illness and like men, especially being afraid to ask for help and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I definitely think that's at play here, but yeah, I don't think Bogdanovich is really going for it, but it's certainly present. You know?
100%. Yeah.
And like what we know about the bulk of mass shooters, they are white boys, you know, they're white young men. And as a result, like, I don't know. I look around my classroom on a regular basis, and like every child takes something different to try to create a relationship and that kind of stuff. But the only students I've been really fucking scared of have been my white male students that I can tell have a lot of pent up rage. And like, it's fucking scary, you know, like they're not a monster. They're just in desperate need of help that I can't provide.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and you know, like it's, I think it's fascinating because this movie undercuts a lot of what has become our sort of template for what the mass shooter is going to be like. Because we have come to blame mass shootings on kids being isolated and them being weird and bullied and picked on and whatever, right? Like we've come this Marilyn Manson listening to kind of goth outsider kid, like that's who we have painted the mass shooter as, and you know, this guy is the most all-American white bread, you know, guy you can imagine. Like he calls his father sir.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, all this stuff, he's married and lives with his parents and they say grace before dinner and all this stuff. And there's nothing, you never get any indication of that there's anything that sets him apart from them, except that he knows he's about to do something horrible and you know it too.
Yeah.
But he never does anything different. He never, you know, like there's nothing in his life that indicates this except that he knows it. Which suggests that any one of them could have been, right? Like, it suggests his father could have been, too. It suggests that any of them could have been, right? Like, if there's nothing different about him, except that he's about to do this thing, then there's nothing to prevent any one of them from being the same way, right? Any, you know, we like to imagine that we can see these mass shootings coming if we just had hindsight. And this movie suggests that we couldn't, essentially, right? Like, that all the things that we tell ourselves we would have seen aren't there.
Yeah. Well, and this may be a little insider baseball, but there have been some incidents in some school districts around here in Kansas City where like they get word that there is a kid that is threatening to do whatever. And it's because like the FBI monitors fucking Snapchat now for like people that are like saying, "I'm gonna shoot up such and such high school," you know? Like, how fucked up is that? That there's probably a whole unit of FBI folks just monitoring kids' Snapchats to see who's gonna, like, I don't know, man. Like, as a school teacher, generally, all of this stuff provides a lot of anxiety for me. But yeah, that's the ultimate fear is when you look at those kids now, they're not the weird ones with trench coats. They're like, oh yeah, like that kid was pretty normal. You know, like he just kind of blended in and was like every other, you know, like he was not special. And as a result, if he's not special, then it could be anybody. Right. And so Let me recommend, okay, before we move to our four movies that we think are pretty similar that you should check out. The absolute best palate cleanser is a video that I'm going to link to here where Boris Karloff and Vincent Price are singing Just the Two of Us. And when I tell you, it is the most heartwarming, like Boris Karloff looks like this kind of lumbering, wonderful grandfather, right? And Vincent Price is the most kind of, I hate to use the term effete, but like, he kind of is. He's a showman, yeah. Right? Like he could have been in fucking Broadway, you know? Yeah. Like he's just so big and joyous and musical that, like, you know, this was a very, very heavy conversation, but I guarantee you I'm going to go back and watch it tonight, it's going to make me fucking smile and just be thankful that that YouTube clip exists in this world.
So. Yeah, Boris Karloff and Vincent Price were both like, just like the warmest, friendliest people in the world, which is great. Like I love that about them.
Yeah. Yeah. And like Karloff really comes across that way in this movie, you know, yeah. Like, he tells a ghost story at one point. Like, he's just charming as fuck. So, yeah, he's great. Okay, so what were the two movies that you thought about?
Okay, so before I actually pick my two movies, I do think it would be remiss. It's not one of the two I picked, but it would be remiss not to mention Blue Steel, which is essentially a slasher movie about a gun.
Oh, okay. I've never seen it.
It's a Jamie Lee Curtis movie. It's from early 80s, so not too long after Halloween. I don't remember the exact year. But it's about a cop who a killer takes their service weapon.
Okay.
And it's been a very long time since I saw it. I may have never actually seen the whole thing, but structurally it's fundamentally a slasher movie, but it's a slasher movie about a gun specifically. So I should mention, you know, Blue Steel. It's not like it's never been done.
I like it. All right. Yeah. Sounds good.
So, the two movies I picked, Spider Baby, which I don't remember the year for it either, but it's around the same time. It's, late 60s. Spider Baby is also about the way horror was changing at that time, but in a completely different way than this movie is. Like, this movie is a very meta movie about how horror was changing, and Spider Baby is just a movie that's both kinds of horror.
Okay.
Like, it's very much Texas Chainsaw Massacre if Texas Chainsaw Massacre had been made just a few years earlier and by someone who made old campy, like, gothic horror movies. And so, like, it's got Lon Chaney Jr. in it. It's got Carol Omart from House on Haunted Hill. But, like, it's about this cannibal family.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's very weird and very, like, it's very much got both feet, like, about 1 foot planted in each time period in a really interesting way. So,
all right, I'll check it out.
Yeah, that's my first one. And then my other one is Anguish, for reasons that I really don't feel like, I feel like I'll wreck the movie a little bit if I talk too much about why I picked Anguish, but just go watch Anguish if you can.
Okay.
And you'll see why, and Anguish is real weird, so.
Very good, very good. So I picked The Hunt, which is a movie that came out a couple years ago. It's got real moments of levity. It kind of suffered from the same controversy that Targets did, in that there was a really terrible mass shooting that essentially shelved the movie for a little while. But it's a lot of a discussion about violence in America, right? And ultimately, both of them come to the same conclusion, which is kind of that it's inevitable, and also that inevitability is kind of the real monster. And I absolutely love The Hunt. It was a super fun movie, not like this one. So it maybe has a little bit of levity to it that this movie doesn't, but also it's not attempting to do anything super serious.
I mean, so I almost brought up The Hunt earlier, but we were talking about, like, these movies not getting made because they were always too immediate and the politics were always too fraught and blah, 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 because The Hunt is a movie that suffered from that, where, like, it was getting boycotted and everything before it was even finished.
Yeah, right.
People were upset that it was being made at all without even really knowing what it was about.
Yeah, and then it came out, and they're like, oh, well, we're upset, but for, like, 180-degree different reason, you know? It was, like, it was kind of fun to watch all of that unfold and be like, oh, wait, the liberals are the ones doing that? Okay, all right. Yeah. But, I think it's Betty Gilbert, Betty something. I'm blanking on her. Gabbert? Anyway, the lead actress in that film is fantastic. She's also the lead in Glow. The Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling on Netflix, right, which is fantastic. So my second film is We Need to Talk About Kevin, which is, I first read the novel, but it's a Tilda Swinton movie essentially about a high school kid that does a school shooting, but really is probably more of a serial killer. And it's really hard to watch, but also really discusses the kind of quiet, unexpected nature of how these things happen, right? Like, Tilda Swinton's child is perfectly normal, right? Like, has a relatively normal upbringing, is just a fucking psychopath, right? And it's that kind of everyday psychopathy, psychopathy, whatever, disease, right? That I find so scary and makes both movies so good. So I would, one non-horror movie that I really do think you need to check out is Blue Caprice, which is the movie that they made all about, oh, there was a guy that was shooting people from like an interstate position in the early aughts. And he was mostly shooting them like at gas stations and shit. And the movie is really, really well made, but there are a lot of these scenes of like shooting from and at and on a freeway, which really reminded me of Targets for sure. And also that documentary that we're going to link to, all of that shit was illegal. They just did it. And that was like, they asked Roger Corman about it. They're like, you know, LA won't let us use the freeways and blah, 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 or wherever they were shooting. They won't let us use the freeways. And Roger Corman's like, just do it. They're not gonna find you, you know, like just fucking shoot the film, you know. And I love that is the advice, because that is kind of how, you know, like, better to ask forgiveness than to ask permission. So proving once again Roger Corman is probably the absolute best. So okay, our last segment as we are wrapping up tonight is our anonymous letterbox user. So for the first time ever, usually they're like pages and pages of like half star or one star reviews to choose from. There were exactly 2 half star reviews and 2 one star reviews, and everything else was like, this movie's kind of good, you know. So I think it's a testament to the movie.
And you know, no one's seen Targets, and the people who have all are people who sought it out for the most part. So they're usually people who were like ready for what it had to offer.
Yeah, very true. Except for this guy.
Except for this guy, apparently.
Yeah. And he argues, first off, this app fucking sucks. Like, man, like, he really hates Letterboxd, despite the fact that he is writing this on Letterboxd. So he's a masochist or something. No one who uses this shit site knows how to review movies. They just spew words. Like, I kind of feel like that's just the internet in general, but okay. This movie is boring. It's talky. It's not a real movie. It's hardly a play. No one does anything interesting, and there aren't any interesting scenes. Not a single aspect of this movie is unique. Visually, it's unambitious. I could close my eyes and wouldn't miss basically anything. Really hard to read that. The slow pushes are ... gay, comma, hack, comma, expected. Do you think he's just being like homophobic and shitty, or like, do you think that there is like some sort of, I don't know, low level gay romance that he's reading into some of this?
I have no idea what he's doing. I think he's just being homophobic. But okay. I do love the nonsense that is the phrase, the slow pushes are gay. Like, I'm not even actually, this movie didn't really have any slow pushes to speak of. I don't actually know what the fuck he's talking about.
Yeah, right. Like, that was not a technique that I would say this movie capitalizes on a lot. And honestly, I probably spent way too much time. These are always my favorite segments, so I spend way too much time thinking about them and finding them. But, like, the only remotely gay thing that I could think of, right, is when they wake up in bed together, right, after drinking. And it's such a funny fucking scene that, like, you know, Boris Karloff rises, right, and, you know, oh man, blinking on his name.
Bogdanovich.
Like, jumps, right? Because he scared him. And then there's this little subtle thing that Karloff does as he walks by the mirror. He looks into the mirror and he jumps at himself. Yeah. It's so good. It's so good, right? But you got to really be reaching, I think, if you think that that particular scene is remotely gay. But I digress. Our anonymous letterbox user continues. The cuts are meaningless. Peter Bogdanovich writing clever lines for himself and giving himself a hot Chinese girlfriend is embarrassing. It's depressing. It's not fun to look at. Its premise is only slightly clever. Boris Karloff is good, but this movie is kiddie stuff. He's old, crotchety, tired, depressed, and I'm sick of it. I left off some. He's sick of it. He's an alcoholic. Wow, amazing. He just sits in chairs and talks. Nothing happens. He then kills his wife, his mom. Big whoop. I've seen this 1,000 times before. So, kind of summed up this whole episode, right? Like, he's seen it 1,000 times before. Yeah, dude, that's the fucking problem.
I like the part where, like, this is the person who complains that no one on Letterboxd knows how to write reviews.
Right. Like, this shit is barely cogent grammatically.
Yeah, I can barely parse this. Like, only because I've seen the movie do I not think you just claim that Boris Karloff kills his wife and girlfriend.
I know. Yeah. Like, pronouns, dude. Like, come on. Proper nouns would help. Come on.
Yep. I'm definitely going to go change my screen name to The Slow Pushers Are Gay, though.
that's my guy. I like it. Well, you're going to change all your names to that. So where can they follow you out on the internet, Oren?
I am on Facebook and Twitter and Letterboxd and all those other places at Oren Gray for now until I change it to The Slow Pushers Are Gay.
And
at OrenGray.com.
Fantastic. Well, you can check more of my stuff out. The Horror Podcast is brought to you by Signal Horizon, a website dedicated to exploring, you know, this slightly academic side of horror. And I do most of the social media and all the editing stuff over there. Or you can follow me at Ty Unsel, where I'm talking about education or teachers or horror or all three of the above. So thanks so much for joining us tonight. What are we going to talk about next time, Oren?
We're going to talk about Malignant, which I finally get to see. Thanks, COVID.
Yay!
2 years for this movie. I'm going to go to an actual theater and watch Malignant in like a week, and I am very excited.
Yeah, fantastic. It's also going to be out on HBO Max, so if you don't quite feel comfortable, joining us at the wonderful Screenland Armor, then check it out on HBO Max. But we're super excited. I've heard it is Jallo-y, perhaps. So
it's Jallo-y. What it looks like is like The Eyes of Laura Mars by Way of the Dark Half, which I'm fine with.
Yeah. Yes, I'm very excited by that description. Yeah, man, I think it'll be a lot of fun. I think we'll have a lot of interesting things to say about it. I also think it might be a slightly less heavy episode, maybe.
We'll see what it turns out to be about.
Unless Malignant is about a fucking school shooter, then we're host. Very good. Well, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We'll check you next time here on the Horror Podcast. Until then, class dismissed. See you all later.